From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle. It's another early start for us as we'll lead you into NPR's live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump. His defense team wraps up its opening presentation today. This hour, we'll hear from Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden. I spoke with him yesterday afternoon. He told me what he thought of the president's defense team focusing on his son Hunter's Ukrainian employment. And we'll also look at San Francisco's move to eliminate bail. How might that affect public safety and the time that defendants spend in jail awaiting trial? We'll get started with former Vice President Joe Biden right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Thank you so much for joining us. Once again, we're on in this earlier hour to lead you up to NPR's live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump. There's a chance we could also be back with you sometime in the noon hour. That because the word is the president's defense team is probably going to wrap up after 2 hours or so as they close out their opening arguments of defense of the president. So whenever NPR is done with its analysis for today, if that's before one this afternoon, we'll come on with a part two of Air Talk. So we invite you to stay tuned throughout the day here on KPECC. Later this hour, the very latest on the investigation into the tragic helicopter crash in Calabasas on Sunday morning. We're also going to take a look at San Francisco's move to not ask for cash bail for those awaiting trial. But first, I spoke yesterday afternoon with Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden. He's campaigning through Iowa. And I began by asking him how he's maximizing the opportunity on the campaign trail with his two biggest competitors, Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, in D.C. for the impeachment trial.
Well, that's not how I'm looking at it, Larry. I was here to begin with. They've been in the Senate for a long time, had to make the tough choices about when to vote, when to not to. But they are locked down. But they've been out here. They were out here in the weekend. I think that who knows how much longer this is going to go, this impeachment trial. But all I'm doing is continuing to do what I had planned on doing, getting to as many Iowa voters as I can to make my case as to why I'd like them to vote for me in the caucus. And this is a tight race out here. And it's a big battle, and the stakes couldn't be higher. The question is, who's going to be able to unite this party and unite the country and beat Donald Trump? And that's what we're all talking about.
With these first two contests in Iowa, then New Hampshire, Bernie Sanders at this point is leading in the polls in both places. You feel like if he comes away with wins in those two states, that is, it is going to do damage to your campaign and your national front runner status or not?
No, I don't think so. And by the way, here in Iowa, I'm ahead in some of the polls, most recent poll to have me ahead. But on balance, we're about a point and a half apart when you talk about it. But look, Iowa's a different place. It's about getting people out, maybe in the snowstorm, to go to a gymnasium and stick there for 3 hours and decide who they're going to caucus for. So I think it's wide open right now, but I feel good about where we are. A lot of enthusiasm. And New Hampshire, there is an overwhelming advantage to any candidate who's either from a neighboring state. I mean, that's been the case for forever, because as they've run their campaigns in their own states, they've spent millions of dollars that flowed over into New Hampshire. But I feel good about New Hampshire as well. But then we go to places where I am really strong, in South Carolina, where I'm winning overwhelmingly, as well as in Nevada, which we're ahead. And so everybody kind of looks at this as the first four. And by the way, California, you guys are going to be starting early voting on February 3rd when Iowa starts up. So, you'll probably get as many votes cast in California as you cast in Iowa on the first day.
We actually would seem for the first time in a long while have a chance to have a significant say in who the nominee will be. I wanted to ask you about the oft-noted split in the Democratic Party between the progressive wing, which appears to be growing, and the moderate wing of the party. Do you think that that is overblown, or do you see the fact that the Democratic Party is becoming significantly more progressive?
No, I don't see that part. The fact is that if you take a look at the elections, the way they've gone on, you know, for example, we went out in 2018. Who won? The people who won and won back the House were all those folks who, in fact, I went out and campaigned for. Not just me, but I went out and campaigned for. Typical in the sense that they are very progressive on race and very progressive on gender and very progressive on the very things that we've always been for. But the question is whether or not that the far left of the party is a concern. And by the way, we've always had a far left and a middle and a right in the party. But I think if you take a look, the numbers indicate that the vast majority of the people in the Democratic, the majority of the people in the Democratic Party people are calling moderates. I wish that I'd been called a moderate all those times I ran for the Senate in Delaware. I would have won with triple digits, anyway, so I don't see it that way, Larry, and I don't see any evidence to sustain that.
Let's talk about health care, where you support expanding the Affordable Care Act passed during your tenure as vice president by President Obama in the Congress. And you've got your two leading opponents both supporting Medicare for all and the public healthcare system being a self-contained entity. Why do you think it's better to have a private system with a public option versus a fully public healthcare system?
Look at all the people you know, Larry, who've worked for corporations, particularly those who are in labor unions that gave up significant wage increases in order to have a very fulsome private health insurance policy that their employer is providing that they have paid for. Under the arguments being put forward by Senator Sanders and to a less extent by Senator Warren, they would have to give up that insurance no matter what. It could only no private insurance whatsoever. And then when asked about whether or not how you pay for this, you have the leading proponent of this, Senator Sanders, saying, I don't know how much it will cost. Your guess is as good as mine. How are you going to pass something, Larry, when you go into the United States Congress? I work like the devil to get Obamacare passed, and I want to get it expanded. How are you going to go in the United States Congress, in a democratically controlled Congress, and say, I can't tell you how much it's going to cost? Granted, the estimates were it's going to be over $30 trillion over 10 years, and I don't know where the money's going to come from, but don't worry about it. We're okay. Come on. You got to get realistic here. And so I lay out exactly how people are going to what they can get under the Obamacare is expanded by me. Obamacare with a public option. If you want Medicare, you can qualify for it and buy it as an option under my plan. You also can be in a situation where you don't have to ever have a out-of-pocket expense if you have the money to pay for your own insurance buy-in for more than $1,000. We also significantly cut the cost of drug prices. Drugs cannot increase prices beyond the cost of inflation. We're going to be able to negotiate through Medicare for what price we're going to charge, and any company can, in fact, charge under my option or under any sale of the drug. So, you know, and guess what? I can get it done. I know how hard it is. I know how hard it is to pass healthcare.
All right. I wanted to ask you, Mr. Biden, as well. Some Democrats, if you were the nominee or whoever the nominee is, would want to see that person really respond like for like with President Trump in debates during the campaign season and be able to parry him. There are others who think it's better to take a high road and not get into a caustic back and forth with President Trump. If you were to be your party's nominee and to debate him and campaign against him, what would be your approach to responding to his particularly caustic comments?
Respond to his lies about what, in fact, he said he was going to do and what he's done. He is only comfortable debating things that have nothing to do with policy. I'm looking forward to debating him on foreign policy, which he appears to know nothing about and have very little. He doesn't even listen to his own commanders. He doesn't listen to his own people.
But if he comes after you personally, how will you respond?
I'm looking forward to that. The way I'll respond is point out that what he doesn't know. Look, the only place this president is comfortable debating is on subjects he knows something about. And that is having to do with attacks and having to do with just trying to slime the other candidate. He doesn't know much about the issues. He doesn't know much about what is going on in terms of everything from the economy to housing on down the line. For example, I guess everybody else reported last week. He said the reason why people have a pre-existing conditions covered is because he did it. Now, instead of talking about him being lying about it, I'm just going to point out he has no idea. He's in court trying to get rid of, from beginning to end, Obamacare. And he's out there saying the reason why people have pre-existing conditions, look,
all right,
that they're covered because of him.
Let me ask you, because we're in the midst of the impeachment trial in the Senate, and the defense opening arguments by the president's attorneys are tying you and your son, Hunter, to corruption in Ukraine and claiming that the president, in bringing up your name with Hunter's, was to try and further this anti-corruption effort. Your response to that contention?
Look, nobody, including his own administration under oath, said anything that I did anything other than an incredibly good job, an honorable job in my role as dealing with Ukraine. And I followed I had the support of the IMF. I had the support of the World Bank. I had support of every one of our European allies. I had support of the EU. I had support across the board. I did my job. The question you have to ask yourself is, did he do his job? And why is it that he's decided to ask a foreign leader to not even actually do an investigation, but announce an investigation of me? Why do you think that's happening, old buddy? Larry, I'm not going to play his game.
Had you talked with your son, Hunter, or other family members about the sensitivity of family members accepting a position which might be perceived as trying to leverage their relationship with you? Is that something you talked about as a family?
No, they'd never done that before. But here's what happened. My son has done an interview, an extensive interview, and a long article answering those questions. And he said, in retrospect, he wished he hadn't done it. No one's accused him of having done anything wrong, by the way. It's just that the appearance. And he said he wished he had never done it because he didn't count on thugs like Rudy Giuliani and the guys surrounding him working with the president to try to besmirch my name. But again, let's stay focused here. Don't play his game, Larry. This is all about what he does all the time. Take your eye off the ball. Focus on something that has nothing to do with him. I released 21 years of my tax returns, Larry. Ask him to release one. If he wants to fight corruption, let's see what corruption he's engaged in. Engage. Give us your tax returns, Mr. President. I'm a completely open book.
I'm impressed you have 21 years of tax returns. That's an astounding archive. Mr. Biden, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it, and we look forward to talking with you down the road during this campaign.
I'm looking forward to seeing you in person, Larry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Former
Vice President Joe Biden, Democratic presidential candidate. I spoke with him yesterday afternoon as he was on the campaign trail in Iowa. Coming up, we'll take a look at the very latest on the investigation and the tragic helicopter crash Sunday morning in Calabasas, which took the life of Laker Kobe Bryant and eight others with deep ties to this community. We'll be back in just 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. I sure hope I'm going to see you this coming Sunday morning at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. It's our 18th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview, and we'll have all of our critics on stage there at the Ace. We'll show clips of the Oscar-nominated films. I was just going through a couple days ago, pulling those clips that we're going to show on the big screen at the Ace. It's a wonderful communal event, 2 hours devoted to looking at the best films of the year. We just used the Academy Awards as the hook to get to do that as we go major category by major category. So we invite you to join us. Tickets are available at kpecc.org/in-person. Just a reminder, because it is Super Bowl Sunday, we have an earlier than typical start time for our Film Week Academy Awards preview. We're underway at 11 in the morning, so maybe grab brunch ahead of time or grab late lunch afterwards and join us at the Theater at Ace Hotel, 11 o'clock this coming Sunday morning. Beautiful Movie Palace, United Artists Flagship Theater from 1927. I hope to see you there. kpecc.org/in-person. Also, just want to let you know, we may be back with you at some point during the noon to 1 hour. We understand from President Trump's defense team that they're probably going to go just 2 hours or so today. They get underway with NPR's live coverage 10 o'clock this morning, and then we may be back with you sometime between noon and 1 o'clock, pending whenever the president's defense team wraps up their opening statements. Well, of course, NTSB investigators are on the scene in Calabasas to try and understand what went wrong in that helicopter flight from John Wayne Airport in Orange County, intending to go to the Camarillo Airport near Kobe Bryant's training center in Ventura County. That craft, of course, crashed just before 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, killing all 9 people aboard. With us to talk about the challenge for investigators, former managing director of the National Transportation Safety Board, Peter Goals. Mr. Goals, thank you for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, even though it's a sad time.
It's a very sad time. So what are the key aspects of this flight gone awry that investigators are looking at?
Well, you know, they've staked down the site. They've gotten an initial view of the wreckage. They've identified what they call, you know, the 4 points of the aircraft, the tail, the nose. They've determined that there was not a data recorder on the aircraft, which is unfortunate. They're now locking down other evidence, like the maintenance records of the aircraft, the pilot's records, his training background, and they're obviously delving deeply into the weather at the time of the accident.
And just to give us a sense a little bit better of this helicopter, can you describe for us a little bit about how common this is in aviation and the characteristics of this helicopter?
Yeah, it is a high-end, mid-sized helicopter, twin turbocharged engines. There's probably over 1,000 of them in service throughout the world in different variants. They're used from everything from executive travel to medevac to military uses. So it's a real workhorse of a helicopter. It has a pretty good safety record, and in the United States, it's a helicopter of choice for high-end private use when they're available.
And what's the passenger capacity of these helicopters?
It depends on the variation. You know, you could probably pack 14 people into it, but you know, less is more common. It depends on the use of the plane.
So it could handle easily the weight then of the 9 people that were aboard in this flight.
I don't think weight or balance is an issue in this case.
Okay, we have the report that the pilot was going to be moving to higher altitude to try and get above the cloud cover. And, you know, in a case like this where you've got coastal fog that's blanketing the area, what kind of an altitude could a helicopter potentially have to go up to clear that?
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to look more in depth at the weather that day, but you know the ceiling was described by various people as anywhere from 8 to 1,400 feet. He clearly got into the fog and was trying to get out of it. How high he would have had to have gone, I don't know.
How does a helicopter pilot decide when either fog is there that wasn't anticipated or trying to work around fog, whether you're going to go under it or go over it? How is that decision made?
Well, it's the personal decision of the pilot. And in this case, the pilot obviously understood that they were approaching an area that might be beyond visual flight rule conditions, because he asked for a special visual flight rule approval, which means you can fly in more murky circumstances. But when you're flying under visual flight rules, which is what this flight was, you leave the decision making up to the captain. The captain makes the call.
And what would be the reason for not using instruments for a flight like this? Would it be that this helicopter wouldn't necessarily be equipped to fly on instruments? Or
I think this helicopter was fully outfitted for instrument flight. Generally in the LA area, which is one of the more crowded airspaces in the country. If you fly, IFR, instrument rated, you are essentially turning over your route and your decision making to flight controllers. So they determine how you're going to get to the place you want to go to, and it may not be a direct route. It may take some extra time. They may route you over areas that you may not want to go to. So if you're flying visual flight rules, you're able to determine your own course and fly as direct a route as you think is safe.
Sounds like in this case, though, that the pilot went up to Glendale. We understand that he waited, and I can't recall whether it was Van Nuys control or where he was waiting for them to give him the okay to move on. So it sounds like almost a hybrid between instrument and just the pilot going on his own under visual flight rules.
When you're on your own on visual until you come into controlled airspace, and when you're in a controlled airspace situation, you sign in with the controllers and you follow their instructions. And in this case, he was told to hold for, I guess, around 12 minutes before he could transverse that airspace. And he did. And then also requested permission to fly, in an enhanced visual flight rule,
He knew he was
getting into some more difficult weather than the standard weather that you would fly it to under visual flight rules.
We're talking with the former managing director of the National Transportation Safety Board, Peter Goles. He coordinated disaster response and directed investigations at a number of aviation accidents. He's currently with the firm O'Neill & Associates, a lobbying firm. He's their senior vice president. Mr. Goles, how will the investigators determine what it was that happened in the minutes before the crash? What are the things they'll look at to try and reconstruct the dilemma potentially the pilot faced?
I mean, one of the things that I'm sure will come up again in this accident is whether aircraft, that are outfitted like this one, whether it should be mandatory to have data recorders, voice recorders, or even cameras on board. If there had been a data recorder, if there had been a voice recorder, if there had been a camera
on board, this accident would be more easily determined. It would be more easy to determine exactly what happened. Without those aids, the team is going to have to look very carefully at the communications between the pilot and the ground. They're going to have to look very carefully at the radar tracking. They're going to look very carefully. There was apparently an iPad on board that had some flight data material on it. If that survived in any way, they'll look at that very carefully. They're going to look at the history of the pilot, what kind of pilot he was, they're going to look at the human factors that went into the decision making to make this flight. But they will get to a probable cause.
And in a case like this, how common is it for a helicopter pilot on a flight like this to encounter rough weather and to set down the helicopter as a safety precaution? Are pilots loath to do that, or is that something that they'll commonly do if they hit unexpected weather?
Well, you've hit on a key issue. Whether it's a medevac flight or a tourist flight into the canyons in Hawaii, or a private flight like this, there's always a desire to complete the mission, and that has to be offset by the question of whether it's safe. And we saw just a few months ago where a tourist flight in Hawaii had a tragic accident when the weather likely changed on them. So it particularly for rotor wing craft that fly at low altitudes, changing weather is always a threat.
We're talking with former managing director of the National Transportation Safety Board, Peter Golds. If you would like to ask him questions about the investigation, which will be a lengthy one undoubtedly, to determine the probable cause of the tragic crash of the helicopter in Calabasas early Sunday morning, which killed 9 Southern Californians, including Laker legend Kobe Bryant, we're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. You can also ask your question on our AirTalk page at kpcc.org. How long do you anticipate this investigation will likely take?
Well, they'll issue a preliminary report within 30 days, which will be completely factual in nature. And if it's a standard report, it'll give readers a picture of where this investigation is going. The actual final report could take 12 to 14 or 16 months to issue.
All right.
It will be in the final report. The draft will be discussed and voted on in public in Washington, D.C.
As a practical matter, because of the high profile of this tragedy, would you anticipate it would have more potential impact on regulations or helicopter requirements than a crash that wouldn't involve significant public figures?
Well, that's a great question, and I think whenever there's a tragedy, of this magnitude that gets this kind of coverage that involves, so many tragic stories, that I think it could lead to more recommendations from the NTSB that will be taken more seriously. I say, particularly, I've been concerned about these kinds of aircraft and other charter fixed wing crafts are not required to have data recorders, and the automation, the miniaturization, has really advanced greatly in recorder technology, and there's no reason why a helicopter like this shouldn't be mandated to have a recorder on board.
Ernesto in Lincoln Heights asks if this is the same model helicopter that Kobe usually traveled in. I don't know, Peter, whether you'd have any information, but from the reports I heard, it sounded like this was the leased helicopter that Kobe typically flew out of John Wayne Airport on.
Yeah, I don't know. I've read the same reports that said that, you know, he used the the one firm. They had about six helicopters, and that he enjoyed using this one in particular, this type of one in particular. So I don't know.
All right. Again, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Are you comfortable speculating on what you think is the most likely cause of this, even if that may not be proven the case a year from now?
I don't think I'd want to. You know, I think we're into this just a few days. Let's see as the facts develop. It doesn't do any good. Good. I think the attention is where it needs to be, and we'll see what comes out of the investigation over the next couple of days.
There were reports that the pilot had specialized training to fly in challenging weather, and I'd seen reports that he in fact had trained other pilots to do that. What might that training entail?
Well, I mean, you know, you train an instrument for instrument flight rules quite vigorously, because you know what you have to do is take your eyes off the outside and really trust your instruments and focus all of your attention on your avionics suite, you know, the information that's being given, and you have to trust it and you have to fly it. In the old days in fixed wing training, they would actually put a hood around you in the pilot seat that would prevent you from looking outside of the aircraft while you train for instrument.
Wow.
instrument flying. And, you know, you'd have a instructor next to you who was not hooded, but you would be hooded, and so that the only thing you could look at were the instruments, and you'd learn to fly without looking outside the aircraft.
And that's not a simulator. That's a real helicopter you're talking
about.
No,
that's you know, as you're flying outside, you were not looking outside the plane. Now, with simulators in today's world, you know, the training is different.
Yeah.
But the key is that in heavy weather, in fog, where you have no ability to see a horizon, you can become easily disoriented, and it can happen quickly. And if you're trusting your senses over your equipment, you're often making a fatal mistake.
Mr. Goals, thank you for being with us, sharing your expertise. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you.
Peter Goals, former managing director of the National Transportation Safety Board, who directed investigations of several aviation incidents, talking with us about how the investigation into the tragic helicopter crash Sunday morning in Calabasas is likely to play out over the months to come. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we'll talk about the controversial decision of the DA's office in San Francisco to forego recommending cash bail. What are the pros and cons of that decision? New York's doing something similar. We'll talk about how that's already playing out and whether other jurisdictions might similarly try to do away with cash bail completely. It's Air Talk on KPCC, back in 90 seconds. We're 18 and a half minutes, no, make it 18 minutes, 15 seconds away from NPR's live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump. I always get teased about my precision with time. When you work in radio, that kind of comes with the territory. All of us talk, you know, down to the minute when we share time here at KPCC. Also, just want to let you know there is a chance that we'll be back at some point during the noon to 1 o'clock hour. The word is that President Trump's defense team likely will only take a couple of hours of their time today. We'll follow NPR's analysis potentially between noon and one, and then that would mean that we resume with the BBC and our regular programming at 1 o'clock right here on 89.3, but time will tell. San Francisco is going to be going to a no-cash bail system as a condition for pretrial release. The new DA in San Francisco, Chesa Boudin, announced this. It was actually something he ran on during his campaign for district attorney. So San Francisco is going to be using what it calls a risk-based system to consider if a defendant might be dangerous or if a defendant is likely to flee and not show up for trial. So what this is intended to address are racial and economic disparities that if someone is awaiting trial and has means, they can post bail and easily be released to come back. But someone who can't come up with the money toward the bail bond isn't going to be able to do that. The question is, do the benefits outweigh the downside of this? Joining us is Laura Bazelon, professor of law and director of the Racial Justice Clinic and Criminal Juvenile Justice Clinic at the University of San Francisco School of Law. Professor Bazelon, good to have you with us again on Air Talk.
Thank you so much for having me back.
I understand you didn't work directly on this policy, but you're part of the new DA's policy team. So let's talk first of all about how this is work. How is the county going to determine the potential of the person to flee or to commit a crime while out?
Sure. So let's back up for a moment and talk about how money bail worked before Chesa Boudin abolished it. Essentially, what money bail did was criminalize poverty for the reason that you said, which is a wealthy and extremely dangerous person could buy their way out by simply posting the requisite amount, whereas a poor person who might even be wrongfully accused would have to languish in prison for months because they couldn't afford to pay. So it actually wasn't tied to dangerousness at all, which is one of the primary considerations under the state constitution for bail. So the way that the new policy works is it takes into account a number of factors. There's an algorithm that's supposed to assess danger, which, while problematic, has also proved to be effective in certain respects. There's also the input from the public defender in terms of the background information they present about the client. There is input, of course, from the assistant district attorney about the facts as they know them from the police report and other information that they've gathered. There's an assessment from the pretrial services officer who's interviewed the person who's accused. And then, of course, ultimately, the decision whether or not to grant release rests with the judge.
When you have a case of someone who is released, who in the past might have been held in lieu of bail, and that person commits a violent crime, you can almost say just law of averages, at some point that's likely to happen. Is the county prepared for the backlash to come from that?
I think anytime you make a change like this kind of a change, there is going to be a fear, of course, of that headline grabbing case. But I don't think that fear can drive policy when we know that the existing policy is not just a catastrophic failure and not directly tied to public safety, but also deeply racist and classist.
Well, and I understand that you don't want that to drive the policy, but is the city prepared, or the county, I should say, prepared for how to respond to that? I mean, what's the counter argument when that incident occurs that the county's going to need to make?
The counter argument to when someone is released on bail and then goes on to commit a new offense, I don't know if it's a counter argument, but of course the response is to take them into custody. I think I should also add, though, that there are a number of things that can happen with respect to pretrial release. So a lot of folks think, oh, well, it's just a bunch of people accused of serious crimes roaming free. And in fact, there are a number of measures that can be put in place and are put in place to protect the public. So, for example, let's say you commit a crime and you have a serious substance abuse problem. One of the conditions might be that you have to enter a residential treatment program to get treatment, or vocational training if part of the problem is unemployment, or electronic monitoring that basically doesn't allow you to leave your house other than to go to court. So depending on sort of the seriousness of the offense and the risks, there are things that we can put in place to mitigate against them. And the other thing I will say is, of course, Chezza Boudin is going to detain people who are dangerous, who are so dangerous that they really can't be in a free society while the charges against them are pending. So it's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. It's just a different way of assessing risk and protecting the public based on objective factors rather than pretending somehow that money equals freedom, and that is somehow good for all of us as a society and for public safety.
We're talking with University of San Francisco law professor Laura Bazelon, also with us from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, lecturer in law, police science, and criminal justice, Eugene O'Donnell. He's also a former NYPD officer and former prosecutor with the DA's offices in the Brooklyn and Queens offices. Mr. O'Donnell, a pleasure to have you with us again. And what are the ways this is working out in New York?
Well, I think the similarity, New York has just enacted this with California, is the total absence of community involvement. This is just an elitist-driven issue. You have think tanks that are driving this, and there's been no public engagement that I can tell. This is a reform by people who think they know best and have excluded communities. And I think if you had some of these conversations in public, you'd get a much better feeling for where the public's head is at. These are deliberately being done now, these reforms, to exclude the public. And at some point, you have to ask, who does speak for victims and communities? You have in San Francisco, you have think tanks, law professors, federal judges, the DA himself now, all on one side of this equation. Who's the victim advocate in that city? And we have the same kind of issues in New York. Who is going to speak for the victims? Who is going to speak for the community? And there needs to be some bail reform without a doubt. But what I object to, and I think you see now nationally, is this writing off out of the picture of anybody with any contrary perspective. San Francisco, I think, and like New York, there's a feeling on the part of the public that they can take some of these risks at this point because the cities are relatively safe. These are relatively safe cities. But we should never forget this is risky business, and you're playing with other people's safety. You're not playing with your own safety. The likelihood that the advocates are going to be affected by any of these reforms is low. The likelihood that people that have no voice in this are going to be affected is very high.
Professor Bazelon's argument was that even under cash bail, there really wasn't a big deterrent here as well, that, you know, if people jumped their bail, they'd be subject to arrest, but it's not like they'd forfeit it. And so, you know, just your response to, you know, you see the fact that there should be some reform of the bail system. But what would be, in your way, a better way to do it?
I think it should be done publicly, and it should be done after great deliberation. It should be evidence-based. It should be analytical. It should not be this ideological push that we're seeing in San Francisco in particular, but other places as well, where you're just talking to an extreme part of the Twitter audience. You're not talking to ordinary people that live in neighborhoods. And there's no question about the fact some people that are going to be received this capacity to be out on bail are going to commit some very, very heinous crimes, not against the advocates, most likely, but against ordinary people. They're going to go back to the most marginalized communities and present a risk there. So there's no question and no doubt about that. Some of them will be homicides. Some of them will be rapes. We have already in New York City the police commissioner under the de Blasio administration, no right winger, he saying that he's very concerned as we enter the new year. There's been a sudden increase in crime statistics in the city that seems to come out of nowhere. And remember, Larry, this is part of a perfect storm now. The police have now been marginalized. The police are no longer a force in either of these two cities and many of the other cities. So you have that dynamic as well. You have a court system that now has no teeth. That's a laughing stock. You have the bad guys who keep score of this, and you have ideologues. You have no, and they deliver.
Well, And we should mention that the San Francisco Police Officers Union has come out very strongly against this policy, believing that it is a threat to public safety. We're talking with Eugene O'Donnell, John Jay College of Criminal Justice, New York, Laura Bazelon, professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law. I'd like to hear from you. What do you think about San Francisco's move to eliminate cash bail for those awaiting trial and using a variety of methods to determine the risk of whether someone could be released or not? 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We're just a few minutes away from NPR's live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump. The president's defense team wrapping up their opening statements in a couple of hours is what the defense team has indicated. There's the chance we'll return and be on with you sometime between noon and 1 o'clock today on KPECC. Regardless, it appears that we will have our regular programming schedule at some point in the early afternoon right here on KPECC. We're talking about San Francisco's move to do away with cash bail. This is a campaign promise of the new district attorney, Chesa Boudin, who is now implementing this system to move away from cash bail. We're talking with University of San Francisco law professor Laura Bazelon, who's on the policy team for the new district attorney. Professor Bazelon, you want to respond to Mr. O'Donnell's comment that this is really done out of think tanks, ideologues, and really without public input from the communities involved?
Yes, I would like to respond. Thank you. A couple of things. The public was extremely involved. This was a grassroots campaign where Chesa Boudin went out almost every night for a year and spoke to community groups and addressed their concerns. And one of the central planks of his campaign was the abolition of cash bail. And to say that there wasn't a public discussion or strong community buy-in is to deny the reality, not just of his campaign, but the results of the election. To say that there's no empirical data to support the idea that money bail does not keep us safe and that eliminating it would make us endangered is to ignore reams of data. There's a recent study that just came out of the University of Pennsylvania studying a similar elimination of cash bail or semi-elimination by District Attorney Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, and it's been going on for several years, so they have data. And the authors found no evidence that replacing monetary bail and supervisory conditions with other kinds of risk assessments had adverse consequences, either in terms of failure to appear or pretrial re-arrest. And that's a study that went on for several years. And finally, I think it's really important to talk about this idea that who is speaking for the victims. One of the most famous cases in California in terms of reform for victims involves a young woman named Marcelle Nichols, and she was murdered in the 1980s by her boyfriend who stalked and abused her prior to that happening. He made bail after he was arrested for her murder and spent the next 2 years out on bail. And in fact, the week after he was arrested and released, her mother ran into him at the grocery store, and according to her, he stared her down. This was so traumatic for the family that they became advocates for criminal justice reform. And we have in many states, including California, something that's known as Marcy's Law, which enshrines victims' rights into the state constitution. And what galvanized this family, I think, was this incredibly traumatic experience where they lost their child and the murderer was rich. So he bought his way out and basically re-traumatized them over a period of 2 years.
So might we see then cases where people will be jailed who otherwise would have been released under this reform?
That is exactly my point.
Okay. Eugene O'Donnell, John Jay College of Criminal Justice, your response to that, that this may keep dangerous people from posting bail and being out?
That's disingenuous. This is designed as this is part of an overall attack on the justice system and the police to delegitimize their functions. And they should come clean about this. And citing Philadelphia on public safety is absurd. This is one of the most palpably unsafe cities, where you have tens of thousands of African-Americans leaving every year, particularly more African-Americans than anybody leave Philadelphia because there's a fear issue in the city. The city's closed down after dark. And by the way, this is true in hundreds of cities across the country where people are palpably scared to death on the street. San Francisco and New York, you have DAs. Most of the people who commit crimes are never apprehended. What are the DAs doing to solve crimes? All you hear about now from the prosecutor's offices is alleged exonerations of people and how they're going to do more to fast-track people out back onto the street. And this is just because it's they're governing through Twitter. It's talking to their subset of
well, and you raised the issue. This may be, you know, part of crime rates being in many communities at historic lows, particularly violent crime. Albeit, I understand Philadelphia, Chicago, you've got other cities with significant violent crime problems. But quickly, Professor Bazelon, I got like 30 seconds here. Is that part of what has enabled this to happen? Is low crime rates?
That's part of it. And I think the other really crystal clear part of it is that massive numbers of people, not just in San Francisco and California and Philadelphia, but across the country, understand that mass incarceration is a colossal failure, that it's racist, that it's classist, and it doesn't make us more safe as a community. And so we are doing what we can to fix our broken criminal justice system. And that's why we elected Cheza Boudin.
Thank you very much, Professor Laura Bazelon, University of San Francisco. Eugene O'Donnell from John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, former NYPD officer, former prosecutor as well. Coming up, NPR's live coverage, Senate impeachment trial. And if it ends before one this afternoon, we'll be on with a part two of today's Air Talk on 89.3. Regardless, it appears we'll get to regular programming sometime this afternoon.